Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome to You're Booked, the podcast for readers, writers and the chronically nosy. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your book inspector, and I will be guiding you as we rummage around a writer's shelves and find some unexpected discoveries. I'm really excited about this week's guest. We went and talked to Sarah Manning. Sarah is a novelist and journalist and writer. I have been a huge, huge fan of her for many years. I used to work for the teen magazine Bliss, and in my old office, Sarah was a bit of a legend. My editors had worked with her and she'd gone off to be an incredibly successful novelist. Sarah has written so many novels. Some of my favourites are Unsticky, which is the very dark, funny, thrilling, really honest and weird story about a relationship between a struggling fashion intern and her much older sugar daddy, but it is unexpectedly subtle and warm and weird. I also loved You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, which is about what it's like to be a woman who's been judged entirely for a whole life on her appearance and what happens when you internalise that judgment. And it's a love story, but she writes the most believable love stories I know. There is so much humanity and heart in her work. Sarah is also a hugely successful teen novelist. She writes brilliant books for young adults, and her latest book, The Rise and Fall of Becky Sharp, which is a modern retelling of Vanity Fair, or it's Vanity Fair now. It begins with Becky leaving the Big Brother house. I'll say that. It's a really sharp, on point satire, and it's very, very satisfying in that it's a pitch perfect match with Vanity Fair. We went to visit her in Muswell Hill. Sarah, I think, had given away 800 books before we turned up. So already, you know, thousands of books left for us to look at. So she reads sort of as prolifically and as addictedly as anyone I know. My favourite people are always the frenzied readers. So the theme of this week is always meet your heroes. We're in the book room.
Yes.
A book room that is now beautifully tidy and just very, very eclectic. I love that there's some, I can see some filing systems and also some exciting things that
are panic of just like, oh, I can't put it on the right shelf.
So I know that you've recently culled 800 books. I've seen the pictures on your social media of your vast and amazing collection. What was the hardest book to cull? Was there anything that you thought, am I absolutely sure I want to give up? And did you have to rescue anything from the culling pile?
I think because I get so many books in to review, because I sort of review books for Red as well. So, you know, it's like every month you don't get to read everything, so you put things by. I think I might actually read them. I suppose the only thing that was a little bit of a wrench was getting rid of my Francesca Leah Bullock Wheatsy Bat books, which is like this cult American series that I, you know, it was sort of really hard to get hold of them, you know, when I was sort of in my early 20s. But it was like, I'm really never going to read these again.
I don't know those books at all. Are they teen books?
They're teen books, but they're just sort of kind of, yeah, they're really sort of dark. It's that kind of dark LA underbelly, and they're kind of all sort of fairies and slightly mystical. everything that I hate now. So it was like, but it was a little bit like, oh, I love these, but it's like, no. And also, I just have a lot of reference books. Like, this is sort of my non-fiction, just tons of like World War II, tons of Homefront, tons of like fashion stuff, including this little section here, which I love, where it's things like, they're so obscure. It's like Charles Creed, like the great British couturier. Who knew that he had a memoir?
Made to Measure, and there's a pun there.
Yeah, and then when I got it, I realised
it was signed. Can't see the book, listeners, it's made like...
But it was signed. Yeah, and just sort of like, these things are just so essential. This is kind of where ideas start. She worked at Balenciaga, but before that she worked at Fortnum & Mason's when, you know, she was a sort of young thing. So it was just all that colour.
So can I just talk about the book? I'll paint a picture with words. It's called It Isn't All Mink by Jeanette Spanier.
Yes.
And it's got the most beautiful kind of red, black and white colour. It's like monochrome with red, black and white cover.
Yeah.
And a gorgeous, glamorous picture of the author looking there. I mean, when do you think that picture was taken?
I think that's sort of 1950s, 1960s.
The quaff and the pearls and the smile.
It's really funny, actually, that these books, they all just have, like, really bad fashion pong.
Why is mink in the title?
I don't know. One's called In the Mink. And then I've got one somewhere that's by the original author, the original editor of Vogue, who literally founded Vogue with Condé Nast, called Always in Vogue. These are things I adore. And then...
So what I think is really interesting about these is... with tongue in cheek, but Ernestine Carter. You don't get many Ernestines. I've never met one.
No, you don't.
But that fashion, I think... These are people taking fashion very, very seriously. And it's something that I think people really tend to dismiss and trivialise. I think I've loved about your books and your characters that fashion detail. Could you talk a bit about your career in fashion magazines and as a fashion writer and journalist?
Well, it's quite funny, really, because I started off on Melody Maker. It's like the world's worst music journalist was just not my thing. And by the end, they kind of made me into their court and social reporter because they didn't know what to do with me.
So how did that happen? Did you think, oh, I really want to be a writer and they're hiring and
loved music. I really did love music, but it was just... I got there and it was quite, you know, for somebody's first writing job, everybody was freelance, everybody was jockeying for position. It was during the Cathedrals of Sound period of, like, music journalism. So it was all very sort of pretentious. And I just didn't have my voice. I didn't know what my voice was. And I just didn't really sort of thrive in that. But then I went to Just 17, which was just like nobody in Melody Maker. You're going where? You're going to Just 17. But I loved this US magazine called Sassy Magazine, which was just like the best teen mag ever. Kurt and Courtney on the cover. And I applied for a job as features editor on Just 17, knowing that I wasn't qualified to be features editor. But you know, when you just have that feeling, you just sort of think, this is going to lead to something. I knew that they loved Sassy too. So I just remember writing my my pitch, like in Sassy speak. I think it was something like 10 reasons why I'd make a spiffy sort of features editor. And they sort of called me in and said, you know, you're completely underqualified. We'd love you to do some writing. And sort of the editor, Sarah Bailey, she's still like one of my best friends. So then I was on Just 17. Love Just 17. It was just... You know, it was what I read when I was a teenager. And I just, at the time, we all just felt really privileged to sort of work there. And that was kind of when I found my voice. It was like, well, I sort of know what my voice is and I know who my sort of reader is. So I did Just 17 for 4 years. And then I went to New Media, which was what we call the internet. God, and...
I think it's going to catch on.
I went back to magazines. They were starting a junior version of Elle called Elle Girl. God, Elle Girl was just the best fun I've ever had. It was like my best job. It was just joyous. You know, it was just a fashion magazine for girls, but it celebrated girls. So we said, we'll never have a diet feature. We won't have like a problem page in the traditional way of I've got spots or can I get pregnant if a boy puts his finger in my belly button. It was all... it was fashion, but it was kind of what I tried to do in my novels, that through fashion we express our creativity, we sort of find ourselves.
Going back to the teen writing, I've always sort of, you know, wondered and imagined whether the fact that I think you've got you've been able to write for teens in such a resonant way is, I sort of imagine you being a big, big reader as a teen.
Yeah, but I didn't really read teen fiction because it didn't really exist.
Can you remember reading anything where you thought, probably shouldn't be reading this? Someone knew what this was.
Well, I don't even know if I could find it. Well, I was just, you know, I would definitely read The Bell Jar, which is over there. That's my copy of The Bell Jar.
So how old were you when you read The Bell Jar?
I was about 14 or 15 because I was still at school.
And was it something that you came to because other people were reading it, or did you?
We were doing. Well, it was this is my A-level poetry thing, and it was just such a great collection. You can see all my little annotated notes, but we did a section on like Sylvia Plath.
Nice handwriting.
I mean, I do actually remember, you know, I was obsessed with the Sylvia Plath, Ted Hughes thing.
So this is the Longman English series, Poetry, 1900.
In fact, that might be my A-level. But I know, so that would be later, but I know that when I was at school, I was obsessed with Sylvia Plath because I left school after my GCSEs to do my A-levels at college. And I was so obsessed with Sylvia Plath that my English teacher at school, even though I was an absolute nightmare in lessons, actually, you know, would lend me her copy of sort of a Sylvia Plath biography. So it was like massively into Sylvia Plath. These are like my J.D. Salingers from when I was a teenager.
Oh, those covers are
just fantastic.
So good.
So I wasn't reading things like that, but somehow, I don't know how this, I took a deep dive into sort of like, bloody William Barrett, this is it. I can't believe I found this. What? Because it, I think because I was into music, like sort of Mark Almond and stuff, that I kind of went this weird sort of cultural route. So I read this and I took it on all the day with my parents. And the good thing about my parents is they just, like, Sarah's a reader, she's reading, just let her get on with it. And my dad,
Cities of the Dark Knight. Cities of the Red Knight.
The outrageousness of Cities of the Red Knight suggests it was written in collusion with Swift, Baudelaire, Schopenhauer, Orwell, Lenny Bruce, General Patton and John Calvin. So my dad said, what are you reading? And I just said, Dad, just like, you know, I actually said it's basically a diary of anal sex. my mum did sort of have a word and say, we don't censor what you're reading, but... So
I'm just imagining you sort on the beach under like a big black parasol going, what?
Jesus. So, yeah.
Was there anything that in that book where you sort of, you had never encountered it before that you had to learn by context or anything where years later you were like, oh, that was what was going on there?
I think it was just more the pose of like, I'm reading William Burroughs than actually taking anything away from it. Because when I was a teen, there wasn't, you know, I literally sort of went from my sort of beloved Noel Stretfields. Really, my teen books were those Gilly Coopers.
Oh, yes, let's talk
those
Gilly.
Those were the books I read. They were much more of like my natural kind of like milieu. Harriet, I literally know Harriet by heart.
So did you read the romances first?
Yeah, because I'm so old that... But this is what was teen fic when I was a teen.
Wow, that... So this is a book called Give Me Back My Pride, published by...
Well, it's this series called Heartlines, which was a Pan kind of imprint. The one that I can't find anymore, which I just read again and again, was called He Was Bad. I'm sure I just like... And it, And it was about this bad boy, you know, and it was just everything that I loved. I'm sure it just inspired me more than I actually realised. And of course, we've got...
Oh, Gigi Bloom.
Yeah. I mean, so many of my books have just disappeared because they were at my parents' house.
What I love is that whenever, because this, you know, comes up a little bit when you talk about all, you know, lots of people, that book, that, oh, gosh, this, I shouldn't be reading this, is Forever with Ralph the Penis.
And I go straight to William Burroughs.
And you go straight to William Burroughs. Also, your Gigi Bloom books are... I love starring Sally J. Friedman as herself. I read this quite recently because I saw it in a Help Yourself box, yeah. And I couldn't not. Can you talk about when you met Gigi Bloom and your connection to those books? What is something I think that she did beautifully as a writer is that transition, which I think is quite Noel Stratfield-y, maybe, of being a sort of, from being like an old kid, a mature kid who's not a teen, to a definite teenager.
Well, I mean, my favourite one, I think it is Forever, but is that... But I think it's only because my cover that I had, she had like liquid eyeliner on the cover.
Oh, really?
But I mean, I wasn't... I know it's sacrilege to say it. I mean, I read Judy Bloom, but they never really spoke to me in the way that kind of the Jilly Cooper books did, where all her heroines were just like chaotic and messy and disorganised. My sort of book buying was like... I can't even remember where I bought books from when I was a teenager. I know where I sort of got like my little sort of chalet school books, which I loved. As a really sort of young girl, is that we would go to Watford on Saturdays and W.H. Smith's. And that's when I had sort of pocket money. I think they were so cheap that I could probably 75p, wow, and I got a pound pocket money. So
what did you do with the other 25p?
Probably, knowing my mum, she probably made me save it.
Because all that, to my mum's consternation, because she loves the chalet school, I've never read. Are there loads of these? It's not like Mallory Towers.
This is like
six.
So my mother read the chalet school, and I read them, and I had like these little kind of Armada things, and then we went to Foyles, and it was in the days when Foyles had a second hand department, and they had the entire Chalet School series, all hardbacks. I think some of them had dust jackets, but silly young me lost the dust jackets. And, you know, we just didn't have much money. And they were pound each, which is just, I mean, now they go for like 50, 60 quid. And it was this sort of horrible, like King Solomon and the baby. They were like 10. Oh, sorry, you can pick 10. So I picked 10 in a really kind of skillful way of what hadn't been released. So they are quite obscure ones, like Gay from China at the Chalet School and Lavender Laughs at the Chalet School and stuff. And I do remember...
That sounds pretty euphemistic to me.
But I just remember coming back in the car and I was so grateful. But at the same time, I was just like... I was fighting back tears because, you know, we'd left the set and then... The next day, I think there'd been a conversation when I'd gone to bed and they'd be like, we could probably swing it for a Christmas present. Phoned up Foyles and said, we'll take them. And somebody had come in just after us and bought the rest of the set. But my one consolation was it was incomplete because I'd already taken the best ones.
I think I might cry.
I mean, it was just... I just remember coming back in the car and just sort of saying, oh, thank you, I'm so grateful, kind of through my tears, because I didn't want to sort of seem like, you know, I was in a strop about it.
The most... such joy and pain.
I know, I know.
Would you ever replace them? Would you... Do you still... There's a bit of you still want to collect the set?
My chalet school, no. I mean, these are things that I just don't even think I'd reread them, but I'd never get rid of them.
I mean, that's something that I think really changes as we grow older. And I think it's so, so sad that, I know, I felt like this when I was little. You know, you don't have that much stuff when you're tiny, and it's really, really precious. And you know kind of exactly what's there. And now, especially with books, and especially because you're...
But also, you would just read those books again and again. That's why it's like, you know, when I sort of read Harriet for the first time in about 20 years, it was just not so much reading it as just... But you know, like when you find an old mixtape that you just listen to again and again and again and again, or like a vinyl record, and you just know, you know, every single sort of catch of breath and stuff, but also all the separate crackles and things. It's that kind of
thing.
And
then if you hear one of those songs in isolation, you expect the thing on your mixtape to
follow
it,
definitely.
And you're a bit surprised when it doesn't.
Yeah.
So what do you think is your most read book? Would it be Harriet? I want to talk about Harriet because I loved it. It's Harriet's the one, isn't it? Is she at Cambridge?
In Oxford.
And it's like, snowy. Oh, thank you so much. And she gets pregnant by a cad. Simon, the actor.
Simon Villiers.
Simon Villiers, great name.
Yes.
Do you know, because in my, I think my favourite romance is Imogen. Where,
yes.
It's Nikki Beresford, the tennis player. And I think it's Beresford Road around Stoke Newington. And I think it's like, every time I think, oh, I don't like Beresford Road.
But Harriet, I think I over-identified with Harriet in that I was sort of like, you know, really messy and just, you know, I just really liked the idea of a cad and then being rescued by somebody with, like, Corey Erskine, the playwright, slightly damaged, like, amazing cheekbones.
Because you read those, and that, because those romantic heroes, they're written, they're very, you know, they're old and they're craggy and they're mature. And then you go back and, like, oh, he's 31.
No, they just seem so old. And also, Harriet has got the best Jilly Cooper dog, Sevenoaks. Hello, Sevenoaks. You've got a cattle market on Wednesdays.
Oh, Sevenoaks is such a great dog name. What I love about, I mean, all this, I think, happens in all of Jilly, and that's why I love her. First books I read where, like, women had sex and it was really great and nothing terrible happened.
Yes.
And she keeps making a point of how Harriet got herself into the mess of having Simon Villiers' baby because she was very enthusiastic about shagging.
I know, but also I think she was the only one that actually, you know, got caught. The rest of them were sort of shagging with sort of gay abandon, weren't they, really? But I suppose also, actually, we can't really sort of talk about my teen years. We're talking of shagging with gay abandon. Lace, of course.
Oh, you have Lace. Oh,
the original.
Oh my gosh.
That's had a few rereads.
So, is it going to fall open at the goldfish bit? This looks. I didn't know this. This is.
Do you know Anna Carey at Chanet? Anna Carey. She actually founded Judith Krantz on holiday. I'll take Manhattan. And these books are just great. You have to read them.
So I need to describe this copy of Lace.
This is the original paperback.
Wow. So this
battered.
Is beautifully battered. It's got kind of gold lettering. Do we know? I'm assuming that's not Shirley Conrad,
no,
but it might be.
There's
a sort of a sexy lady's face in the cover, and she's got like a lace sort of mantilla on her scarlet lipstick.
Yes.
But Lace, I always forget how it's a story about friendship and, you know, love and connection and that sort of that tenderness between women as much as it is about
goldfish.
Sexy shakes and goldfish.
Yes. But, you know, I read. Oh my God, I just. This is filthy as well. And she sort of wrote.
Can I borrow it?
You can if you want. Judith Krantz sort of wrote these books, and there are all these sort of like literary illusions in them, but just like really sort of no holds barred kind of like fucking.
Because that's another and, thing.
I mean,
that,
it was 13, 40. I mean, these are much ruder.
All of these kind of, but you know, sexy books, but they're all like, oh, and it was like. Is that Purcell I hear? Is it people throwing around bits of Wordsworth?
Because people always go on about how Riders was a bonkbuster. But come on, anybody that's read Princess Daisy or Lace, just like, that's not a bonkbuster. This.
You were 13 or 14?
Oh, God, yeah. Of course. And just, you know that age where you're just, I think even younger, just so curious about sex. I would just be like a plague of locusts on my parents' bookshelf, just anything with anything rude. Read all my dad's James Bonds at about 11, 12, just for the rude bits.
I was just thinking about there's that bit in, going back to Judy Bloom, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, and Laura, the girl who is sort of a mystery to everyone because she's got breasts, and that bit about her letting boys feel her up behind the A&P. And I didn't know the A&P was like a convenience store. I thought that was part of the sex act. What's an A&P?
I think this is probably why Judy Bloom didn't really sort of connect for me, because I was already on the hard stuff. And I just remember, I think I was about 11 when I read Lady Chatterley's Lover, trudged through it just to get to the rude bits. And it was just...
I really do think there is something about being a teenager and reading, because I think it'd be quite hard as an adult to be like, yeah, I'm reading Burroughs, or to be that sex obsessed and that pretentious and that curious about who you're going to be and how you're going to build yourself through these books.
Oh my God, Blake Nelson, this book, Girl by Blake Nelson, with the most horrible cover. This is the book that made me write Guitar Girl. I wouldn't have written teen fiction. It's just brilliant. The cover is awful. I bought this the first time I went to New York in about 95, 96, and this is a book. It's about a girl, but he actually writes it from a girl's point of view, which normally I'm a bit like, oh, dude, don't do that. It's probably one of the best depictions of a teenage girl. And it's kind of Portland, and there's like this guy called Todd Sparrow in a grunge band, and they're big in Seattle. And it's just the first thing that happens in the book is her friend Sybil like shaves her head, you know, because it's all just, you know, all about downtown. And
had you heard about that book before you bought it, or did you pick
sassy.
It up and think
sassy? Oh. It was sassy serialized it, and you know, it was pre-Amazon days, so I literally went to the big Barnes and Noble in Union Square with a list of books that had been reviewed in sassy to sort of and I read it on the plane coming back. And I it wasn't like, oh my God, I'm going to go away and write a teen fiction. But it was like, oh God, well, if you're allowed to write books like this, I can write a book like this. So, but there are bits in Guitar Girl, my first YA, that I think I've just like lifted out. You know, when you're just so subsumed by a book that you don't actually even realise that you're doing it.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
We'll be back to Zara shortly, but I want to tell you about my steal of the week. This is a book that I love so much that I feel as though I've nicked the crown jewels by simply paying the cover price for it. This week I've chosen Life is Meals by James Salter and Kay Salter. They are a husband and wife duo and describe themselves as amateur chefs and perfect hosts. Now, I came across James Salter for the first time because my husband, producer Dale, was reading A Sport and a Pastime, which is a famous literary work about bumming. Life is Meals is very, very different. It's beautiful. Every single day of the year, they talk about an historical meal or a recipe you can make or something delicious or a food memory that's connected to that day. So I think I can say that today we are recording on the 17th of November. Ooh, so today, 17th of November, fondue. And they've got a lovely few lines from W.H. Auden. A poet's hope to be like some valley cheese, local but prized everywhere. And there's a bit of a description about fondue and why melted cheese is so wonderful. I've had this book for a while and I was inspired to revisit it because it's the anniversary of another book I really adore, Nigella Lawson's How to Eat. And I think that sometimes, like the Salters, I'm a keen amateur cook, the strong emphasis on the amateur, but reading about food is such a pleasure. And if you're listening, the nights are drawing in and it's getting a bit chilly, you know, all I ever want is, you know, soup and stew and baked potatoes and delicious, cosy, filling things. And reading about them when that writing is done as beautifully as the Psalters do is almost as good as sitting down to the actual meal. So that's my Steal of the Week, Life is Meals by James Psalter and Kay Psalter. That's published by Picador and that is available everywhere. And now back to Sarah. Are there any writers in particular, sort of adult writers, where you feel yourself sort of drifting and getting their voice?
I find it quite easy to kind of slip in. Dive a Provincial Lady, which I love. This is quite a new copy. There's a really battered copy upstairs. Once you've read a sort of Dive a Provincial Lady for a couple of evenings, everything you try to write is just sort of, you know, got letter from bank, you know, about overdraft. I've just bought new hat, you know, and now it's time to water my bulbs. I don't know, I think also I've been doing it long enough now that I am sort of quite in control of my own voice. So, you know, Guitar Girl was my first YA, so it's the first time I'd ever written a book, and Unsticky was my first adult novel, and it took about 10 goes before I actually kind of found my adult voice, because that leap from YA to adult fiction is not a huge leap. It's kind of quite a subtle, nuanced leap, because I wrote the older end of YA. And so I was going from writing girls that were 17 to girls that were 23. But, you know, it was quite...
Nothing changes, but everything does.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have any sort of favourite historical book villains? I think your latest book, I think it'll be your latest book at the time of airing, is The Rise and Fall of Becky Sharp, the retelling of Vanity Fair, which I adored. And it is contemporary, and Becky is such a brilliant villain. But she is... I don't know, do you think she is a villain?
I mean, she is an awful person. She absolutely is. I mean, especially in, like, the original Vanity Fair. I mean, she's responsible for, like, you know, a couple of deaths. Yeah. So, you know, when I was having lots of conversations with my editor about, can you warm her up a bit? No, I can't. You know, she hasn't killed anybody yet.
It is really exhilarating to read.
It was really cathartic to write, actually. Just every mean thought that I'd ever had was sort of channelled into Becky.
Have you ever read books or met characters where you felt bad for not liking them, or had a sense of, I really should be enjoying this, but it's no?
So much, especially sort of reviewing, because, you know, there's a lot of chatter sort of goes on as sort of, you know, proof copies go out, and you will be reading something that everybody seems to love. And I just sort of think I just have to cut out all that noise, because, you know, it's, I have to see whether I like it. But I do sort of think that life is too short to waste on bad books or books that you're not enjoying. So, you know, if I've read a book and it's been like shit, I'm really sort of resentful that my precious reading time has been taken up with sort of something that wasn't good.
Is there anything that came, anything sort of, oh no, I'm not going to like this, and then you've been really, really surprised by it?
Well, actually, probably not for Red, but Station 11. Somebody sent me a proof and it just sat on my desk. I was just like, ugh, I don't do dystopia. Ugh, why would it? And a travelling troupe of Shakespearean players? No. But then people were sort of raving about it. And I was just like, oh, you know, I'll give it a go. Why not? I'm open-minded. And I loved it. And also, it's just one of those books I genuinely think about the ending of it, like, at least once a week. And I read it about 6 or 7 years ago. I still think about the ending. These are my beloveds. Because I've been doing all this decluttering. So these are my beloved, beloved, beloved Susan Scarlet, a.k.a. Noel Stretfield.
Oh!
So, in the 40s, she wrote these really amazing kind of torrid romances, which are all about sort of girls. This is my favourite, Clothes Pegs, which is set in a top London fashion store. And then this one is set in a London dress shop.
How did I not know about this? Oh,
and
my
what
God.
Is really interesting, so she wrote them as Susan Scarlett. And then
such a good
what
name.
What is really interesting about Noel Stretfield's adult books is not so much the Susan Scarlett, but her adult books are just like dark as fuck. Like, this is so dark. This is called Myra Carroll. This is one of Noel Stretfield's adult books. And then Saplings, which is a Persephone reissue, again, really dark. But what's really interesting about all her adult stuff, including Susan Stretfield, is why they're so rare and nobody really talks about them, is that during the war, there was a huge, during the Blitz, there was a bomb basically fell on, like, the UK publishing Paternoster Row, and basically sort of all those books in the warehouse just... Poosh, so her, this is why her books don't turn up in second-hand stores, because they burnt down. This one, Myra Carroll, is quite interesting because it's a Collins White Circle for Good Reading, but it's actually a book for the armed forces. So paper was rationed, but if you can actually see, there's no margins
amazing
at all.
Amazing tiny print.
Yeah. And just look at the margins. There's no margins because you've just got to... But these shelves, I've got my Persephone's, I've got my Susan Scarlett's, I've got my little Dean Street Press books that they send me. I've got Virago's, I've got my Penguin Classics. I've got a whole little section of reference books for, like, all about London. So when I'm writing these amazing Wardlock guides,
there's a beautiful,
just get them for the year that you're writing, and just it tells you where to go if you need a vet, it tells you how much the tube is. These things are just, like, amazing. The Knights of London, the Heart of London. I've got my Live Alone and Like It by Marjorie Hillis, several editions of that, which is probably going to inspire a novel in about 2 years' time.
Oh, I hope so.
And then just all sorts of things. My Sarah Gay Model Girl books. It was amazing. I found
those.
This one on my mother's shelf, took it, and then I went to Edinburgh. Interestingly, I went to this bookshop, which is run by the people that were reprinting the Susan Scarlett books, and found all the other Sarah Gay Model Girl books. So, and this is a vintage Mills and Boone.
Oh, Heart on Tiptoe. The fabulous dancing lady smelling her armpit while a handsome man looks on. If you were going to write Mills and Boone and could choose a pseudonym, have you thought about what it would be?
They would love me to write.
They bloody would.
Sarah Scarlett.
But they don't really have those names anymore. That's a sad thing.
I wish they did.
It in the 1960s. Or the 1930s. Oh, it would just be something amazing. It'd probably be something like Verity Darling or just...
I think you'd make a brilliant Darling. Have you ever stolen a book?
Yes. Yeah, I can tell you which one, actually. Well, one that I can remember. This book is amazing. And for years you couldn't get it. Starlust by Fred and Judy Vermorel.
Oh, we have that.
I think it was Faber-Fines reissued
it. Yeah, but not for years. So when I was on Melody Maker, I kind of like was hanging out with a band and they lent me that and I was just like, it's never coming back.
We have that book and we're obsessed.
Fred and Judy Vermorel, they just went and interviewed all these fans about their obsession with pop stars. And some of them are quite tame. Some of them are so far from tame.
There is the most astonishing sort of Barry Manilow. It's like slashfic, isn't it?
Not so much the Barry Manilow. My God, me and my friend Kate, we still to this day, just on any birthday card, well, at least we have our interest in the chapel, just from a line in Starlust, where she's the best one, where she's kind of... She's just sort of saying, you know, oh, my husband sort of said it's embarrassing when we have people round because you're all Barry this, Barry that. And I say, well, I don't understand why you're being like that. Your sister has her interest in the chapel, doesn't she? So oh my God, there's just like really like intense, like weird fantasies about David Bowie. Mm. There's one about Rick Foxton from The Jam.
Yes, I remember. And it's the boy, isn't it? Is it something about like him coming into the school toilets?
Yeah. And then there's an Adam Ant one. Again, to this day, me and my friend Kate just like to exclaim, on your knees, punky.
So who did you steal it from?
Somebody in a band called Tiny Monroe. I'm never getting, and it's just, you know, it was like, you know, it was before mobile phones. It was like, never getting that back. I'm just trying to think.
And if which book would you commit serious crimes if someone were to steal it?
Probably something like my Shelley School hardbacks, just because you can't really get them without paying a fortune. But just kind of the circumstances.
I'm back in the car with you.
The circumstances. Yeah. Well, this one, actually. This is amazing. I wanted this for so long and it was so expensive. It's London at Night. There's an exhibition at the Museum of London called London at Night, but they're actually using they're not even photos, they're photogravures. Just look at this. It's just beautiful. Isn't that just amazing? And it's like a London that doesn't exist anymore.
I don't want to be weird, but that book smells incredible.
I know. It really does, doesn't it?
That's a real... When people talk about the old books, I don't know.
Have a whiff. And this is amazing. London West, which is all about, like, the dress shops and things. And it's written in that style of, you know, when you sort of see, like, old sort of Pathé newsreels and it's a really patronising man saying, hey, little lady. And this is just... This is brilliant, and it's called
London West by Frances Marshall. The illustrations are beautiful. Do you know who did them? Does it say?
I don't know. Let's have a look. It's that sense of London.
Gosh, because that picture there. So this is.
It's Royals.
Royals from.
This is another one. This was my mum's book, and it's about
Laugh at Defiance by Mary R. Richardson.
She was the suffragette that slashed the Rokeby Venus.
Oh.
And it's just, you know, my mum bought it and I read it. When I went to university, my tutor was like, well, obviously it was your first feminist text. And I think the only reason that my mum bought it is it was reduced from 12 and 6 to 1 and 6. But I read it and it's all, you know, amazing and it's all about force feeding and stuff. Unfortunately, after the suffragettes, she went and joined the British Union of Fascists.
Oh, no.
But it's such an amazing...
That sounded really sarcastic. I wasn't meant to. I was thinking she just had to have a cause.
But I went to a party a few years ago and I got talking to this girl who was an artist and she was doing this whole kind of thing on suffragettes and sort of like putting herself in those photographs. And she was just, I was going like, oh, you know, I've got this amazing biography of a suffragette. She just said to me, it's Laugh of Defiance, isn't it? And I just said, yeah. She said, I knew you were going to say that. She said, I couldn't find a copy of it anywhere. They don't even have one in the women's library. I found a library in Australia and they photocopied the whole book for me. And suddenly I just met, and now I've just met you randomly at a party and you've got a copy. So just little, you know, it's just little weird things about books. I think what I love about Twitter so much, especially bookish Twitter, is that I'm just, it's lovely, and I'm just in this kind of coterie of women who all read the Shelley School, all read the Lorna Hill Sadler's Wells books. We all love Georgetta Heyer. You know, it's just, you know, and when I was sort of growing up, I didn't know anybody. The other thing that I must show you, actually, talking of, well, the things that are beloved to me more than anything else. On here, they've got their own shelf now. These are my mother's Georgetta Heyer novels. Every single one of the romances, you know, and they're just, these are more precious to me than, like, anything at all. Just because, you know, they're in my mum's. These Pan Macmillan, my memories of being a child, we had them all on a shelf and I would pull all these ones out with, like, the pretty ladies and just sort of stare at them for ages.
Was your mum a fan? Did she introduce you?
Well, the sad thing is that, you know, she would always say, oh, you know, you'd love it, you'd love a Heyer. I'm like, oh, shut up, Mum. I'm reading, like, Sylvia Plath and I like William Burroughs and I don't want your stinking Georgetta Heyer. And then, you know, as I got older, it was just sort of one of those things of, like, I will read them. And then my mum died. And I would go and sort of see my dad, and I didn't have anything to read, so I just pulled Regency Park was my first Georgetta Heyer, and it's just like typical, because she invented like the Regency romance, so it is flighty heiress, sardonic older sort of guardian, cheekbones, you know, there's a carriage, you know, race, and oh, it's just brilliant, and it's just like, oh my god. So I sort of just took, I took the Georgetta Heyers, you know, like that Johnny Cash song where he sneaks a Cadillac out one piece at a time. It's like, I'll take two Georgetta Heyers a week. And I, you know, my biggest book regret is that I didn't read them when my mum was alive. So that was something that we could have shared, because she bought every single one, you know. And some of them are like the Bodley Head first editions with the Barbarossa illustrations, which are amazing. But then I still really love those little pan Mac ones. So
those ones that you had the first really tactile memory of.
And I suppose above all else, those are the books, you know, that if the house was on fire, like literally MacBook, Georgetta Heyers, because they were my mother's.
Can you imagine the conversations you would have had with her about those books now? Do you read them and sort of hear her? Not in a spooky way.
Yeah.
Or in a spooky way, I don't know.
I just, you know, it would have been really nice to sort of share them, you know, and even sort of reignite, because, you know, she was not very well at the end and she just didn't read. It would have been really good to sort of get her audio books or something like that. So sort of as I was discovering them for the first time, she could rediscover them. So, yeah, I mean, that's just sort of, because that's a great thing about a really good book. You want to sort of share it with somebody. Even though sort of reading is this really kind of, it's a really solitary, insular thing, but also what's amazing about it is that when you sort of love a book and you meet somebody else that loves the, it's kind of a shorthand, isn't it?
It's so intimate, isn't it? Because it's, if you love the same books, it's almost like saying, I can be alone with you, and that is rare.
And especially those books that you did read, like when you were sort of a teen, like that really shape you, like the Jilly Coopers. You know, I still think that I'm trying to sort of find a man like Corey Erskine. It's like people say to me, Dylan, Diary of a Crush, or, you know, I'm still looking for Dylan. I just think, well, don't, darling, because, you know, he's just like really not good boyfriend material. But it's sort of, certainly I don't sort of think that I would write the kind of heroes and heroines that I write now if it wasn't for sort of things like, you know, Jilly Cooper's early novels and actually sort of my mum's Mills and Boone that I used to read at a really shockingly precocious age. My parents were like really, my parents sort of grew up very poor, so sort of second, third generation Jewish immigrants. My mother grew up in a Samuel Lewis trust building, wasn't allowed to go to grammar school when she passed to 11 plus, was made to leave school at 15 because my grandfather just didn't think girls needed an education. My father had to leave school during his A-levels because his father had died and he needed to earn a living. So they were just like, you know, they were just so big on education and sort of, but also reading. So I was read to every night. I mean, my dad would read Twinkle to me, like Dolly Hospital. I was always read to, but quite quickly I was reading myself. We didn't have money for books. So every Saturday I was taken to like the library to get like my maximum six books, which I just read again and again.
Have you ever had a library fine?
Oh my God. Yes. Oh God. I just remember when I was a teenager, I got all these books out. I just couldn't be bothered to take them back. And then sort of in the end, honestly, they were like about 2 or 3 years like overdue. And they sent out letters. I did take them back. It was Burnt Oak Library. And it wasn't, you know, they did have a go at me. Do you know what? It wasn't that bad. But I do actually sort of remember that while I was at the desk getting a bollocking, this nosy old man actually just took one of the books in the pile and lifted it so he could see like when the book had been chewed.
I love that. Sorry, the teen rebel with a massive library fines. A huge thank you to Zara. It was such a joy to look at her book collection and it felt like a real privilege. I would recommend every single one of her books. The latest,
The Rise and Fall of Becky Sharp is published by HarperCollins, and that is available everywhere. And Unsticky, which I mentioned at the start of the episode, was published by Headline, and we'll put a link to her work in our show notes. Thank you all so much for listening. We've had so much love and support, and we're so excited to hear from all of you. If you want to find out more information about the show, go to acast.com/booked. You can email us at whybooked@gmail.com. You can say hello to me at NotRollerGirl on Twitter, or the Daisy B, that's B as in the insect, on Instagram. And I will be posting lots of shelfies and book pictures there for you to have a look at. Also, keep an ear out because we will be planning some live events. All the dates are to be confirmed. They'll probably be happening in 2019, but they'll be announced over the next few weeks. If you like Your Booked, please share the love, tell your friends, and if you rate and review us, it's hugely helpful to us and it helps other people find the podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back next week. Goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.